Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco to continue our series where we are reading through the Chronicles of Narnia. For our purposes, we read what was originally written as Book 5 this week, which is The Silver Chair, which immediately follows the events of Prince Caspian. It was like the next major event in Narnia's history after
Prince Caspian. Yeah, they make a reference to it being after the Dawn Treader.
After the Dawn Treader. So it actually does pick up. And it's the first of this. I mean, it's a story without the Pevensey children in it as well, which is also was very interesting. Rereading with that sort of
total shift.
New characters in Narnia.
Yeah. With the next three books, essentially, you're going to get that.
Yeah. So he's sort of gone beyond those initial tales and expanded into there. So before we go on commenting and reading through, just want to remind everybody that The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. We have a lot more than podcasts at 1517, though I think podcasts are maybe the best thing we do. I'm a little biased.
We certainly have a few of them.
But we certainly have a few podcasts. But we have a daily blog over on the 1517 website, which includes a blog cast, which is essentially a live read of the blog. And, you know, I've really come to appreciate this because I was on a couple of news sites the last couple weeks, and they all have this at the top of their blogs or their news articles, just like we do, this play button where you can listen to it instead. But do you know what it is 99% of the time? It is the robot, like Siri, Google Assistant voice, like stone cold reading the article to you.
Instead of Craig D'Onofrio's sultry, smooth voice.
Instead of a real person.
Sultry.
And so I have really come to appreciate this. This idea was given to us by the late Jeff McRae, who did the blogcast for over 2 years.
Yeah, several years.
And now has been taken up by Craig D'Onofrio. And again, I'm very thankful for the idea. And now that we seem to be maybe one of the only websites on the internet not having a robot read you the blogs. So if you would find that a convenient way to read the blog.
I find it a convenient way to get caught up on some of the articles while I'm driving.
Yeah. I'll go ahead and do that. Yeah. After listening to that, I could hardly listen to these.
Unless it's one of my own articles and then I don't want to listen to it.
Yeah, that's definitely true. On that note,
I understand. I'm reading your dissertation right now.
Oh boy, I bet you do understand.
Have either of you?
No, it's actually really good. It's just I haven't read anything so scholarly in so long.
Oh boy.
So
wow. Have you guys had the misfortune?
You've got pages that are like all footnotes.
Yeah, I did some serious footnoting in there.
I had the misfortune of listening to a first year Thinking Fellows episode the other day. Have you guys done that? No,
I won't do that.
No.
I mean, listening to a 6 year younger self on there was brutal. So
the funny thing is that I don't usually listen to Thinking Fellows, but occasionally, like when we're driving, Mom will want to listen to one that we have done, and so we'll listen to it. And sometimes I'm like, "Hey, that was pretty good." Yeah.
I think that when I listen to the new ones, because when I edit these, I go, "Wow, this is." I don't fear my own voice like I did when I originally edited shows, but the old voice, holy cow! It just is weird.
Isn't it funny that he thinks it's actually changed, Adam?
Well, sometimes I listen to him and I'm like, "Whose voice is so sultry?" And then I'm like, "That's oh my gosh, that's me.
That's me."
Just kidding.
Well, now that we've wasted everybody's time, we can we can get back to the Chronicles of Narnia. So the Silver Chair doesn't have the Pevensey children, but it does have a character that we met in the Dawn Treader, Eustace Scrub, still an unfortunate name, as Lewis mentioned once again.
Who's mostly referred to as Scrub in this
last
book,
name.
Because they come from a school that does not allow them to use their Christian names.
That's interesting. Yeah, there's a very formal relationships all
So
around.
You'll hear a lot of Pole and Scrub, or read a lot of Pole and Scrub instead of a lot of Jill and Eustace.
Right. And
What's the school's called again? Experiment School?
The Experiment House.
Experiment House. Yeah.
That's kind of an obvious dig.
Yeah.
Are they educating? No, they're experimenting.
Though some of it is no longer like an experiment. You can see pieces of this in sort of the way we talk about education. One of the notes about the Experiment House was that the children all provide nice little psychological experiments for the teachers there to, question and wonder and sort of scratch their itch. So if a child does something bad, it's not bad. It's psychologically interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And the teachers there are probably working on their, and I have to apologize ahead of time, working on their EDDs. And so they're writing their dissertation based on what they're observing in the classroom. Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't this have been sort of at the nascent years of the PhD in sociology?
Yep.
Yeah. So.
And right. And probably, I guess, I don't know exactly, but probably around the time when you get the professionalization of doctorates.
Yeah.
Bad move.
Yeah. Interesting.
So now that you get just, I don't know, 9 times out of 10, a dissertation has the word perception or feelings in it. You know, perceptions of blah.
No assertions.
In this environment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's one of the things you have to like about this, though, in all the Narnian books, is that Lewis actually makes assertions about things through the narrator and through Aslan quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I like that.
I think the important part of this is that doing this sort of allowing children to be a psychological experiment where they sort of raise themselves in this environment, and then teachers are there to observe and not correct, but promote this self-raising.
It's like a Montessori school, except for beyond preschool. But you do get the sense that there are stricter rules here.
Yeah, but it's that begins the trip into Narnia, because Jill needs rescuing from sort of this environment. This environment has allowed a group of children to become a terror to her.
Right.
Yeah. Bullies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's cowering behind the gym, right?
Yep. And crying.
And Scrub comes to her defense.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. I mean,
that's where it all starts. And then so one thing about this book, I think before we went live or hit record, I think I said it's a little strange.
It is strange, yeah.
And compared to like the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which is, I think, as Caleb put it, adventurous, and you kind of envision it in your head.
It's got a classic
Silver Chair is hard for me. It was hard, like Puddleglum. It's hard for me to imagine what he must have looked like. What he would look like.
Yeah. I think there's several of Lewis gets beyond sort of the normal mythical beasts in this too, in quite a few ways. Yeah. And so you have to create a picture of, say, Puddleglum in your head, and actually some of the other characters too. And he's doing, this is more of a, this is definitely darker than the previous books. I'd say that, but I think that there's a pretty fair representation of a couple theological, ideas going on here that I didn't, because I had listened to the Alistair McGrath podcast on this, and they basically, unless I'm remembering wrong, they basically just said there's not much going on here, that's theologically interesting. I actually think there's a couple things.
I think there's a theology of the word in here.
Absolutely. And I was going to say by virtue of catechesis. So I think, one of the things that happens right off the bat is, well, there's a couple of things I really, really love about the beginning of the book. One of them is, like Adam said, Jill is hiding behind the gym. Eustace finds her. They actually go hide together. He starts talking about that he's been to this land where there's talking beasts and things like that. And she basically says, well, how do you get there? And he's like, well, I don't really know. And then they kind of like stumble on this idea that maybe you can call on Aslan.
And stand to the east, Aslan.
And make him
bring
you
there. Putting their arms out in front of him or something. It's
almost
everything
like
in this
summoning
book.
Bloody Mary in a mirror, right?
Yeah. And then so they do, right? And they end up in Narnia, but they end up on a precipice.
Well, they don't end up in Narnia, actually.
Well, okay, they end up in the mountains, in the High North.
And Aslan makes note that they're not in Narnia.
Yeah, but they end up in sort of, I don't even know what to call that world, but the world in which Narnia exists.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because they're in...
Because you can go beyond Narnia. I wonder...
They're in the high mountains that they were able to see in the last... in the Don Treader and in... in the Don Treader. They're in those high mountains.
Yeah.
So that's where they end up, and they end up on a precipice, and Jill begins...
taunting.
Taunting about it. Anyway, long story short, she thinks that because of her actions in a couple ways, right? First off, letting go of Eustace, that Eustace has fallen to his death. She thinks he's gone. She's like, we called on this thing that I'd never heard of before. I ended up in this place that I'd never seen before. I was messing around. I wasn't letting Eustace save me. And in the process of not letting Eustace save me,
I knocked him off the cliff.
And he's dead. And now I'm here. So crap, you know, and, I actually think there's part of that that's fun. Eventually what happens is, Aslan shows up, and what he's doing is he's blowing essentially. And she has no clue what he's doing, like why he's blowing. But he's blowing, and he's this giant lion, like doing the Superman blow when he's putting out a fire. And what he's doing is he's blowing Eustace into Narnia. She doesn't know that. But afterwards, when he's done doing that, he starts talking to Jill. And that's when she starts to kind of figure out, you know, maybe where they are. And she makes the point, and I thought it was awesome. She says to him, I'm not going to get the words exactly right, but, well, we're here because we called you.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, hold on, sister. You could not have called me unless I had called you, or called on me unless I had called you first. And I thought, wow. This is one of those things where Lewis's theology of faith and the word and calling on the name of the Lord is spot on. You know, out of the text of scripture, Pauline in its origins, at the very least. And just, I mean, that's our, I don't want to Lutheranize him again, but that's our confession that if you have faith, it's because, not because you went out and sought God and found him or decided to follow him or any of this, but because he called you to himself. And once he has called you to himself, now you can call on his name.
Yeah, it gets to Lewis's theology of miracles, almost, that we talked about in the episode we did on his conversion, which is that, like, you can't use God like a magic trick. So you can't summon Christ in a spell. You can't say his name three times and do this. You don't have the ability with your word to control God, even if it sometimes looks that way. So something like prayer isn't calling on the magician to do a trick for you, right? If the magician, in this case, does the trick, or so you think he does, it was because he first actually had this purpose in mind. Yeah, just interesting.
Yeah, and we probably ought not go further.
No, yeah.
Otherwise, it becomes speculative.
No, I wouldn't. But I think it's pretty clear there. I mean, that Aslan straight up says it, that you couldn't have called on my name unless I had first called you. And I was like, wow, didn't remember that. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think it is notable how quickly Aslan shows up in this book.
Yeah, right off the bat.
Versus the other books, where he is sort of, he's talked about to everybody by other people. So he has believers who then share that the news of Aslan with everybody, and you're always sort of waiting for him to make an appearance. Whereas he is the one who causes the journey this time and actually sends two people to do a job.
Reluctant, and Jill is reluctant the whole time.
Yeah.
She's a reluctant apostle, if you will, in this story, sent to do Aslan's bidding to kind of, again, once more, restore Narnia. Now, Narnia is not in disarray at this point, but it's about to be, and it doesn't even know it. And I think that's interesting, too. So I think the second sort of theological theme that you see here quite a bit, well, I'll get to the catechesis thing in a minute, but eventually one of the ones that you see is there's a spiritual warfare kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Unseen.
Yeah, because the villain in this book is, of course, still Jadis, who's gone from being the White Witch to being the Green Witch.
Well, the book doesn't call her Jadis. I mean,
it doesn't.
It says of the same type. So, I mean,
I think it's Jadis. You
might find out at a later date, but he doesn't say that. That's an assertion that the book does not make.
I would have to remember the line or look for the line, but I think there is one direct assertion to it. At least allusion to it being her. But long story short, what I was going to say is she appears in person in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And here she appears in person, but at first she's just, a serpent who has killed the prince's mother. She's an illusion. She's a figure on a horse that seems nice and is leading you astray. By sort of making the children not remember Aslan's words. And then she's quite clearly, once they get underground, she's a demon, mm-hmm. right? I thought that was interesting. The big one that comes still early is, so when Aslan meets Jill on the cliff or the precipice, he tells her she's going to have to go into Narnia. She's going to have to do a job. And eventually he blows her into Narnia too, which is kind of funny because she's on air and she falls asleep and then in the whole nine yards, which I thought was a great little,
very weird.
She takes an air nap. She's going in. But he gives her, he makes her remember four signs, right? He says, you'll encounter four signs. And then he makes her, sort of through rote memorization, repeat them until she gets it right. And you get the sense that she's there for a while, like repeating it, getting it wrong, getting corrected, repeating it, getting it wrong, getting corrected.
I got the sense that this was a reschooling because her school didn't do what all good, teachers should do at the beginning of education, which is you don't synthesize, you don't teach,
you memorize.
You just memorize. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he does this, and the four signs, it really reminded me of, like what you would do in a catechism class, like the first, as you're trying to teach students the Ten Commandments or the Apostles' Creed, in our case, and sort of Luther's explanations of these things. I remember doing this when I was in seventh and eighth grade at my Lutheran day school, and this is like memorization. And I, like, as Jill is sitting there in front of Aslan reciting this and getting it not quite right, it reminded me of my friend when he had to recite the Apostles' Creed, mixing up ascend and descend, and then having to like go write it 10 times again and come back and do it again. And
he ascended into hell and descended into heaven. Yeah.
And I have to admit, I'm holding kids in church these days a lot, and so I don't have the hymnal or a bulletin in front of me, and I sometimes make the same mistake because I just get into this sort of trance-like state and forget where we are, and it's kind of embarrassing.
Oh, I have to – I don't have to read it, but I often want the hymnal because, I will mix the Apostles and Nicene Creed together just come up with my own little blend.
Yeah. So he does that. And the four signs are interesting. I don't think you can draw like a one-to-one theological sort of conclusion with each one of them. But one of the things I remember Jim Nestigan saying about the fall is that one of what the serpent did to Adam and Eve is convince them to rely on their memory instead of God's words, or to rely on what they thought God said instead of what he actually said. And this happens to Jill because Aslan literally tells her, you need to repeat these to yourself when you wake up, when you go to sleep, when you wake up in the middle of the night, and at mealtimes, repeat these signs to yourself so you don't forget them. And she tries to be diligent about it in the beginning, but the more time passes through the book, the less she does that and the less she can actually remember the four signs, and the more she has to think about them and the more she kind of gets them wrong and doesn't recognize them. And I thought to myself, what a good case for even as an adult sort of going through the catechism more and reciting these things to yourself, because the less you do that, the easier it is for you to forget things like the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer. I got a lot of value just even in that sort of like instructional thing. What does it mean to be a Christian? It means to know the Word of God. How do you know the Word of God? You got to repeat it to yourself.
Yeah, even linguists and anthropologists and social scientists generally have observed in a secular environment how words, in a way, shape reality. They would say create reality, but words, the more you speak or read, or we might say confess, the more that's detailed your worldview gets.
That's your world, Yeah. Well, and it pans out for her. She ends up, I don't remember the word they use, but they keep on saying we've mucked up or we've...
Yeah. They've been mucked up.
They don't... They muck up the signs, right? They don't...
Three of four of them. Three of the four are, sort of like completely missed, which is a very interesting... I think that's another point where it's Aslan... still sort of causes things to move on where the signs should have been, even though she and they miss them.
Right. So the first one is the one that they detail the most, that Lewis details the most, how missing the sign has affected the journey, right? Because essentially the journey is the children are to go find this lost prince that's the son of Caspian, and to bring him back and restore him to the kingdom, because Caspian's old and he's going to die, and Caspian literally at this point doesn't, since his son has disappeared, he does not know who he will name as king when he dies. Trumpkin, who's his sort of royal confidant, is old too. But the first sign is that when Eustace first gets into Narnia, he's going to see an old friend, and he has to immediately go up to that old friend and sort of announce himself that he's there. And you think, well, like, geez, that's a weird sign. But you find out that, one, Eustace doesn't do that. Two, Jill doesn't tell him the quickly enough when she gets there. Eustace doesn't recognize Caspian because he's older, and so he doesn't, even if Jill would have told him, it's doubtful that he would have recognized Caspian and gone up to go introduce himself. But what you find out happens is that Caspian then sails off and is out of the kingdom, and Trumpkin's in charge, and the owls end up telling Eustace and Jill there's rules about pursuing the prince because so many people have tried it and so many people have died. And that
Trumpkin is so loyal to the rules and to Caspian that he's not going to waver on the rules while Caspian's gone.
He's not going to allow them to go do their quest to go find the prince.
But that if Caspian had known, and the owls say this,
that if Caspian would have known that Eustace was sent from Aslan, he would have given him an army to go get the prince, and this all would have gone easier.
Yeah, their journey would have been pretty smooth sailing.
I thought, but I think there is a point to... Okay, so here are the signs that God has given us. If you follow those signs, things will probably go pretty easy. But even if you don't follow the signs, God in his will make come to pass what he has deigned to come to pass anyway. It's just the journey is going to be harder.
Yeah, I think that was interesting that God's necessary work is still being done just for those on the ground here. they're sort of missing his word, misremembering his word, just makes things more difficult.
Is this a point about the law?
I think it is. I think there's an inevitability. I mean, this is going to, I don't want to get us in too much trouble.
Yeah.
But we don't want to go to- you're going to, you know, there's a truth to the fact that if you were to follow God's law perfectly in your everyday life, you would be doing what God's will for your life and those around you is, and things would probably go easier. Right.
Yeah. Because the law is, because it's from God, it's good.
Yeah. But you're likely not going to, but don't lose hope. God's will for you will still come to pass because it's of his necessity and not your doing. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of, what will the path be like? And we can all see this. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I think to say that the consequence of missing commands, from Christ has effects in this life, right? I mean, when right. Luther says the law is the most beneficial doctrine for this life, you know, had they encountered Caspian, for instance, the journey would have been comfortable.
Yeah.
One of the most characteristic parts of this.
They might have been carried in litters to go find
them. Yeah. I mean, one of the most characteristic parts of this journey is how uncomfortable it is. I think anybody who's ever been really wet in the snow,
lost in the mountains,
and had to keep going knows how impossible it is to get warm once you're cold. Like that description in there of like they were so wet that they couldn't. You know, they sat down in the snow at certain points because you couldn't get any wetter than
they
were.
Puddleglum was pretty sure it was a trap, but they were so cold that it almost didn't matter at that point.
Right. Yeah. That you can get a sense that
until they found out they were going to be eaten.
Yeah. They were never going to be that cold if they had actually been able to do what Aslan said. So
you do see. Speaking of Puddleglum, you do see sort of Lewis's difficulty naming things with both Puddleglum and the fact that he's a marsh wiggle. You know, where does he live? In the marsh. And what does he do? Yeah, he wiggles around a little bit. Yeah. So he's a marsh wiggle.
He's got like web feet. And yeah.
He's a frogman and he's glum. Puddleglum. Yeah, glum. You're like that is.
He lives in a puddle and he's a glum guy.
Yeah, that's.
He's one of my favorite characters. Because he's grumpy. Mm-hmm. He's a true believer, but he's grumpy.
Yes.
Right? I Googled search Puddleglum just to get images in my head. And because I always think of Dr. Rosenblatt when I think of Puddleglum.
Oh, that's funny.
But every image I get of Puddleglum on Google is like this tall, slender.
Tall, lanky, yeah.
It's messed me up.
That's funny.
So the journey's uncomfortable. They do have to. So the do you have the four?
I do. I actually
in front of you. You want to just read those for people?
I do.
I wrote them down too. If you want me to,
oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So you want the first one read already, or
yeah?
Okay. So it's as soon as the boy Eustace sets foot in Narnia, he will meet an old and dear friend. He must greet that friend at once. If he does, you will both have a good help.
That's like the end of the fourth commandment.
Yes.
Yeah. Honor thy father and mother, that it be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. Well, yeah. What happens if I don't honor my father and mother?
It won't go so well.
Yeah. What's the second one?
You must journey out of Narnia to the north until you come to the city of the ancient giants.
Yeah.
Yep.
Should I just keep reading them here?
Yeah.
The third sign is you shall find the writing on a stone in that ruined city, and you must do what the writing tells you.
Now, she doesn't see, so they don't end up doing the second sign. They end up going to the city kind of the kindly giant, what they think are the kindly giants.
being prepared to be eaten.
Being prepared to be eaten, and Jill's put in a room where she's sort of nannied by a little nanny that keeps thinking she's like a little baby.
As soon as they were going to the city, I had already put it together that they were going to be the feast when she was like, go for the feast. Tell them about the feast.
I was like, you guys are so slow.
And I was like, this is another consequence of what was said in Don Treader of Eustace, that he had not read the right kinds of stories. Because if you had read stories about giants before, you knew that they think people are very tasty.
Yeah. But I think it's funny is that, so they're in the city of the kindly giants. I forgot the name of the city. She's put in this room, and Aslan actually appears to her again.
Yeah, in a dream, yeah.
In a dream. And
to set her back on the...
To set her back on the track because she can't remember the signs anymore because she's not repeating them, and actually reveals to her this city of the ancient giants with the writing that just says, under me.
Yeah. All right, Adam, and then what's the fourth one?
Let me read it so I get it accurate. You will know the last prince if you find him by this, that he will be the first person you have met in your travels who will ask you to do something in my name, in the name of Aslan.
Right.
Aslan.
And that's actually the only step they get right the whole trip.
And because even, he asked them to untie him out of the silver chair, which is...
In Aslan's name.
In Aslan's name.
Which even then, while I was reading it, as they were debating untying him, I was like, so my gosh, they're not going to do it. They're not going to... I'm like... like, Jill's going to stop them from untying him. Oh my gosh. No. But, no, and then that, I loved the imagery of him breaking the chair, too.
Yeah.
The first thing he
first
did
thing he
when
does, he,
released,
he breaks
is
the
break the chair.
Yeah.
Like savagely, he's like beating it to pieces.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then the witch comes in and once more casts a spell on them. And if you think about it, the spell that she casts is getting them to forget the signs again.
Mm-hmm. And that's their first
purpose.
Their first encounter with her is a day's journey from the second step, which is to find this ancient city of the giants.
She's the one that tells them about the city of the.
Of the friendly giants.
Friendly giant.
The way she gets them to forget isn't by telling them that that word is wrong.
No, she just distracts them.
She just distracts them and tells them about something that seems nicer.
Nicer and better.
You want to go to an ancient ruined city of giants? What about this living city of the friendly giants?
Where there's warm beds and full tummies.
And by the time she said warm and full, they were just...
They were in.
They were a single-track mind to...
Tell me about the spell though. This enchantment. You know, she's playing. Was it a mandolin? She's playing. And
yeah, she's playing a mandolin.
Everybody's sort of like, in this trance-like state. But everybody down there in that underworld is enchanted, and it's almost like behind it is again Lewis's critique of modernity. Or materialism.
Yeah, everybody's busy, but they don't know what they're busy with.
Yeah, and they don't believe these other things exist. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. So I told you that the silver chair, to me, reading it again now as an adult, I haven't read it in probably 30 years. It was just weird. Also because I'm trying to read it very quickly and so on. But also there's a lot of, is the word profundity to it?
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot of stuff in the background.
Yeah.
A whole lot of very subtle critique of, if you will, progressivism in education and the materialism of modernity, which tells me, this is just a note to self, I need to go back and read The Silver Chair when I've got a whole lot of time and think deeply about it, because I think it's profound.
Yeah, we've pointed out some of them that Jill has no idea how to do rote memorization or what it takes to keep up on such things. Her education hasn't provided that. They haven't read the right books. They're encountering things that, in Lewis's mind, they would have encountered before in their imagination if they would have read
an imagination
the proper books, and they haven't, and so they have no idea that the giants are going to eat them, and the rest of us are going, of course they're going to eat you. That's
I think the essay is called On the Reading of Old Books or something like that. It's in God and the Doc, I believe, where he starts right away. He talks about how people prefer, rather than reading Plato directly, people prefer reading books
about Plato.
That dissect everything. And it takes forever just to get to what Plato said and so on and so forth. People aren't reading the right books.
Yeah, and so I think they continue to encounter this, but I think it's interesting that even if she's not Jadis and she's just a type like Jadis, which we're going to have to discuss when we get to the magician's nephew, because how many types like her made it in from her land? That'd be a good question. But beyond that, I think one of the things that's going on here is that you can be led astray – So if she's a demon, right, or a devil-like character, if you can be led astray, if you take the difference between sort of the appeal to Jadis in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe from Edmund, the appeal to Jadis by, I forgot the name of the black dwarf in Prince Caspian, who's like, I don't care if the horn brings us Jadis, that's great. If the horn brings us Aslan, that's great. I want out of this mess. And then the appeal to sort of the demonic character here, or from the demonic character here, there's a point at which that don't expect the temptation of the devil to come and shake you off of your foundation on God's word in just one way. In this way is very subtle. There's a very, like you said, there's sort of a calming herb that fills the room, and then she plays soft music, and all it's really doing is sort of distracting you off of remembering God's word.
There is something, there's a unifying principle in all three, which is that the word that Jadis speaks is always comfortable. So to Edmund, it is comfortable. It's this, you know, this Turkish delight that he just wants more of. He wants to just, again, go back to her castle, be warm, and have endless halls of this amazing food.
I still think it's worth noting then that when they wrote this, the Brits would have still been on rations. And so...
Yeah, so Turkish delight.
This is why, you know, like I said, when we talked about mere Christianity, is why Lewis can reference getting an orange, and it's a big deal.
Right. In Prince Caspian, you know, for the black dwarves on the whole, it would just be the comfort of having Narnia back. It would be life being easier again. It would be life not in hiding. It's about ease. And then here in this, both for the prince originally, and for the children on their journey, it is comfort and beauty and all of this. She offers him the throne that's already his.
Well, right? He goes off to find, I mean, the way he gets captured is he goes off to find the green serpent that bit his mother and killed her. And he goes off day after day after day after day after day after day after day to do this. And when he's finally asked about it, he says, well, I've given up finding her a long time ago. But what I have found is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And it's just this distracting lady and her beauty.
The serpent, turns out. Yeah. That's interesting. I do think you could make, there's probably an argument to be made for the Jadis. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the book doesn't say she is Jadis. It says that she's a type like, and, I would say the other similarity is she's going to gain the throne. This time it seems like the lesson learned from Jadis with Edmund was not to go about it so directly, but she still needs a
figurehead
or a human. She still needs a human to be king.
Narnia was created to be ruled by
man. And so this time, I'm going to wait for Caspian to die and have a now enchanted prince rule. I'll marry him, and I will be queen of Narnia because I'm married to the man, rather than sort of like, getting the children instead of killing those who would reign on the thrones, which is, you know, it's like the game plan's changed a little bit. Yep. It's like, oh, I gotta work a little bit towards this. So I think, but it doesn't go right. There's a lot of, I think by this point in time, it would be fair to say he's definitely working on the ideas for the last battle. Because in the underground, and when they're asking the warden, as they're being taken to the queen's chambers, right? They see strange creatures. They see another man, Father Time, trapped in her cavern, all this. And every time that they ask the warden, what are these? The answer is, these are beasts or a man from the surface who have been here a long time, and it is said that they're going to wake at the end times.
Yep.
They're going to wake for this last battle. And so you do have a reference.
I think this is the start, with an interruption, this is the start of...
Seeing the army being formed.
Seeing the end.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
I also thought as I was reading it, I think this one seems like it would be very easy to adapt to film. Like, it's actually kind of a shame that it ended. He's very descriptive. I actually think more descriptive in many ways than he is of people, places, and things happening in Prince Caspian.
Yeah.
For instance, like the descriptions of all the characters of the giants. You have going from this mountaintop to colorful Narnia to the, you know, the mountainous land of the giants to bleak underground. Like, there's a bunch of scene and color change and character change in it that seems like it would adapt to film very
well. I think it would. And hopefully, Dan Price has told me that Netflix has bought the rights to doing the movies. And I said, oh, I hope they don't miss all the Christian stuff. And he said he doesn't think they're going to. So,
you know what I heard or I read? Because I was curious. I had heard years ago that they were going to make Silver Chair. And I guess they actually did record quite a bit, but Douglas Gresham, that's the stepson of Lewis, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to get, yeah. He eventually pulled his support because they were turning it into some sort of like girl power type thing.
Oh. Yeah.
That's what I read on one of these Narnia geek blogs.
They'll have to be real careful about that with this because it just doesn't lend itself to it.
It would be kind of a myth.
No, in fact, some people would. I've read elsewhere. I've criticized the Silver Chair, especially Lewis's description of Jill Pohl, as suggesting that Lewis is sexist and so on and so forth.
Well, there's
she's always crying, and
there is a line that I love, but
with the map in the head.
Girls don't know about directions.
He does make a clarification where he says. Girls don't generally know about directions, or maybe it's just Jill.
Yeah. Jill does make a remark to the prince when he's under the enchantment because he's talking about how amazing the queen is and how he just listens to her and does everything she says. And Jill goes, well, where I'm from, women who just listen or men who just listen to their wives aren't very respectable.
Oh boy!
Oh boy! one of the things I think is funny is too, and I think I said this in the last one, is that this book specifically references by title the next book in the series, which is The Horse and His Boy, when the blind bard is telling a story in the court that when Trumpkin holds the feast. I just think that's so clever. So, all right.
Well, cool. Then. Yeah, I thought. Yeah, I thought it was very enjoyable. I thought it was, I liked all the scene changing. I thought it was colorful from the beginning to the end. And part of it was probably because there were so many weird characters, he had to do more descriptive work.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
But it worked out.
Yeah. I mean, I think I read it 7 years ago with Autumn. That's probably the last time I read this, and I really enjoyed it again. I finished Horse and His Boy, too, and I had forgotten how much I enjoyed that book.
He has to keep reminding us how far ahead he is. To us, Caleb.
I'm halfway through I know. Magician's Nephew.
And he always, I don't know if you know this, Caleb, he texts me like an hour before we record. He's like, so are you busily reading the last bits of the book?
You know, Adam, we should just say to him, some of us have children to raise.
I have a dog.
Yeah, wow, that's horrible. You're part of the problem.
I raised children already.
He's got his fur baby.
Yeah.
I've raised children already.
That's true.
Yeah, you have.
Well, guys, great episode. I'm really enjoying this series. I've actually seen we have a uptick in listenership with this series, so maybe we've struck a chord or scratched an itch with people. So if you're new to the Thinking Fellows, thank you for joining us. If you're hopping in the first time here and you liked it, you'll probably want to go a couple episodes back as we've been doing the whole series. Next week, we will be doing The Horse and His Boy.
Yeah, set during the time of Peter the High King.
And again, that's just a reminder that we are reading them in the order written, not the chronological order. So Horse and His Boy, then we'll read The Magician's Nephew, then The Last Battle.
Yep.
All right. Well, great, guys. We will catch you next week. Thank you for listening to the show. Bye.